This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, is there any chance Aaron Rodgers will be returning to the Green Bay Packers next season? We'll have the very latest on the future of the green and gold and their longtime MVP quarterback. But first, the federal government seized two financial institutions over the weekend as Silicon Valley Bank and New York Signature Bank both collapsed. The FDIC says it will insure all deposits in the banks, even above the normal $250,000 limit on insured deposits. On Monday, President Biden tried to reassure the public that the cost of this action will not be directly passed on to them.
No losses will be borne by the taxpayers. Instead, the money will come from the fees that banks pay into the deposit insurance fund. Because of the actions that our regulators have already taken, every American should feel confident that their deposits will be there if and when they need them.
The Biden administration has avoided calling it a bailout for these banks, but some financial analysts wonder if the White House is setting a new precedent by insuring deposits above the $250,000 mark set by the FDIC. We're learning more about what led to these bank collapses and what Biden's response means for fiscal policy moving forward, and we welcome you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the government seizing these collapsed banks? Do you agree with the Biden administration's decision to insure bank deposits above the $250,000 limit? And are you concerned with the precedent that this might set? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email us, ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is James M. Murray, professor of economics at UW La Crosse. He teaches about macroeconomics, money, and banking. James, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Let's start with what happened. What happened last week to Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank? Why did they collapse?
Well, there were bank runs on both of those institutions, and no bank, healthy or not, can survive a bank run. Banks take our deposits. They keep a small fraction of them on reserve, ready for us when we need them. And depositors can ask for their funds without notice as much as we want, whenever we want. But banks don't hold all of our money in reserves. They loan out a large fraction of that. And then the other thing that they do with our funds is they invest it in pretty liquid assets like treasury bills. Liquid means you can convert it quickly to cash to meet your depositors' needs if you want to. But treasury bonds, it's when the U.S. government goes into debt. They sell these promises to make those future cash flows. Those are assets held by the bank, and they can earn some interest if the bank doesn't need to sell those off. But there were runs on these financial institutions, and there were really three reasons. Now, FDIC ensures that your deposits are covered, even if a bank should fail. If all of the deposits were covered, then there shouldn't have been a bank run. But these two banks were unique in that only about 10% of their total deposits, at least that's for Signature, Silicon Valley Bank was similar. A very small fraction of those total deposits were actually insured because they have so many commercial clients, businesses, medium-sized businesses that need to make payrolls every 2 weeks, every month, whatever that might be, that were keeping balances much, much higher than that $250,000. And then the other thing that happened is the assets that were being held by these banks, now the commercial loans, the mortgages, those loans that the banks make, those aren't liquid at all. The liquid assets, so those treasury bills, those have been declining in value if you're gonna sell them on a secondary market. Now, if you hold them to maturity, if you have a five-year bond and the bank wants to hold it for 5 years and collect those cash flows from the United States Treasury, there's no risk whatsoever. But if you need to sell those bonds in order to meet your depositors' needs, what's happened lately with interest rates increasing as the Fed has been trying to fight inflation, bond prices fall. And so the value of those bonds have fallen. And so it's become more difficult for these banks to meet their depositors' needs.
Well, James, let me stop you there, because I'm curious about that federal interest rate is one of the reasons I saw people saying this was the start of the bank run, is that these banks were kind of tied up in U.S. Treasury bonds, weren't liquid, and interest rates were making these banks investments challenge. So what role did the Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes play in these banks? And if it played a role in these banks going under, how come it has not infected other banks as of yet?
No, good question. So this is, it's also been quite predictable that the reason the Fed is raising interest rates is to try to increase the cost of borrowing, kind of bring down spending in order to try to reduce demand and bring down inflation, because inflation has been a problem. Whenever we see high inflation, we should see the Fed responding by increases in interest rates. And the Fed's been clear about their intentions on raising interest rates. Next week on Wednesday, I bet you you'll see a statement by the Fed that they're increasing interest rates by another quarter of a percentage point. This is affecting absolutely every bank in the country. And this is not the first time that the Fed has raised interest rates either. So this is quite predictable and widespread. So that can't be the only story. The last part of the story was that Signature Valley Bank, for example, was very specialized. Most of their depositors and their loans, or a very large fraction of their depositors and loans, were venture capital funded small to medium sized startup companies in the tech industry and in the health tech industry. And the tech industry in general has seen, has been struggling lately. Yeah. I think Facebook just announced another round of layoffs just yesterday. Google's announced layoffs, Microsoft's announced layoffs. And I'm sure those smaller companies in the tech industry are hurting too. And so what that means is when these smaller tech companies are also hurting, they're probably drawing down their deposits. And so these two financial institutions are actually seeing higher demands on their deposits than probably most banks around the country. So we have that problem. We have the problem that most of their deposits are not actually FDIC insured. Mm-hmm. And we have the problem that the most liquid assets that the banks could have to sell to meet their depositors' needs are also losing value.
James Murray, our guest, professor of economics at UW-La Crosse. We invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. What did you think about the second and third largest bank failures in U.S. history over the weekend? What did you think about the Biden administration's intent to step in and help them above the $250,000 limit that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation had generally stuck to? And 1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to join us. But I'll ask you, James, what precedent this sets when the federal government's willing to go above and beyond the FDIC in covering depositors of these two banks that went under? They still don't want to call it a bailout, but is it?
So bailout's not a very precisely defined term. So we could easily have an argue about that depending on our definition. I would say in many respects, it's not a bailout. Signature Bank and Silicon Valley Bank, they failed. The owners, the shareholders of those firms, they lost their money. They lost a lot of their money. And the employees are going to be losing their jobs. Management has already lost their jobs. So they'd made mistakes and they're paying for it. So they were for sure not bailed out. So who was quote unquote bailed out? Who was bailed out were the clients of the bank, the customers of the bank. It could be depositors like you and me, but also they especially serviced a lot of venture funded small to medium-sized businesses. So it was those businesses in the tech industry and the health industry that were using Signature Valley Bank not as an investment tool, but really as just a service for providing transaction services, depositing their revenues, and then cutting paychecks for payrolls. And so it was those institutions whose deposits are guaranteed. So they're seeing relief. They can meet payrolls this week because Sunday night, Monday morning, that was a significant question about whether these small businesses would be able to meet their payroll obligations for this week.
And for many, the 15th would be payday. And let's go to your questions now and comments about these banks going under and what's next for our fiscal policy going forward at 1-800-642-1234 with our guest, James Murray, professor of economics at UW La Crosse. Greg and Rhinelander, you're on the air.
Yes. Is that Rick and Rhinelander?
I'm sorry. Did you say I've got Greg here, but you can be whoever you want to be.
Okay, I'll be Rick. So I have two questions for your guests, and thank you for taking my call. The first is during the Trump administration, part of Dodd-Frank was rolled back significantly, the capital requirements for banks, that is the fraction of reserve that they keep, to prevent having to have this kind of problem. And more importantly, the stress tests where they would evaluate, well, what would happen if interest rates went up? Or what would happen if we're in a concentrated, non-diversified situation like these banks are, where all their clients are in one sector of the economy? I'm interested in that. And I'm also interested in the question of moral hazard. Whereas if we now bail out any depositor above $250,000, what is to prevent the banks from taking extreme risks? There's no, as long as the government's going to backstop everything, there's no reason to even consider risk management. So I'm interested in those two areas.
Great questions, Rick. Appreciate the call. And let's start with the rollback of regulations in 2018. Did that play a role here as you see it, James?
That wasn't the major role here, because these banks as of a few months ago, they had positive net worths. These banks were holding treasury bills, bonds, fairly liquid assets to meet their to be able to meet their depositors' needs. So they were, I didn't look into the full financial details of these banks, but the problem wasn't that there were inadequate capital requirements. The problem was is the declining values. I'm not saying there wasn't mismanagement, right? There was mismanagement. This was quite predictable that interest rates would be rising, and therefore the value of those bonds that the banks are holding as part of their assets to meet the depositors' needs, those are declining in value. That was quite predictable. That risk was inadequately addressed. I don't see it as a problem with the rollbacks of the requirements.
And what about the moral hazards of and going forward, James?
So a moral hazard problem in general is when you whenever you take any kind of risky action, if you take some risky action, if there's a big payout, you get your big payout. If there's a big loss, somebody bails you out and somebody else's problem. And if that's going to be the case every time, or there's an expectation that'll be the case the next time, then you're going to have this problem of banks taking on too much risk. So I do not think there's a moral hazard with the financial institutions. And the reason I don't is because the banks themselves were not bailed out. Signature Valley Bank was seized by the federal government. All its assets are going to be sold. The equity holders are going to be out all of their money. So a lot of people are going to lose their money. These are the owners of the banks. So they for sure are realizing the consequences of their actions. The ones who are quote unquote bailed out, or the ones that are assisted here, are the customers. So where there might be a moral hazard problem, though, is if you're, say, a wealthy individual and, I don't have this problem. If you're a wealthy individual that has balances and checking accounts of several million dollars, something that exceeds $250,000, you might fail to, diversify your portfolio of just where you put your deposit accounts. Maybe make sure that you have a larger fraction of your financial wealth insured that way. So there's the potential there. But as far as moral hazard with financial institutions, I don't see it, because these banks failed.
We're talking about bank collapses and federal fiscal policy with UW-La Crosse economics professor James Murray. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Did the two bank collapses cause concern for you and your money? And what do you see going forward after the Biden administration eased concerns earlier this week for depositors of those two banks? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. Our conversation continues here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with James Murray. He's an economics professor at UW-La Crosse, here today to look at the collapses of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank and the response so far from the federal government. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to your questions now. We'll go to Gail in Fish Creek. Gail, good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I've been watching this on several fronts. My question is there's one question and a comment. I was looking at whether they were, how much they were into, invested into crypto and where that all is. And with the meltdown that FTX took, if they were connected in that. And that may have caused big money investors to be pulling out, which all it would take is a couple of the big ones, the whopper whale investors, to pull out, and that would leave the whole bank vulnerable. But then Signature Bank had Barney Frank on the board, and if anybody remembers him from the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the mortgage meltdown issue that happened with the Glass-Steagall and all, he was... his fingers were all over that. So I'm wondering why anybody would hire him. And he was connected with Signature. So what's going on with the crypto with those two banks?
Yeah, thank you, Gail. And what is the role that crypto plays in the failure of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, James?
Signature Bank they specialized in transaction services to crypto startups. So they weren't providing services and for the cryptocurrency itself. They were providing financial services for companies that were involved in cryptocurrency. 27% of the assets at Signature Bank, 27% of the clients were digital asset or crypto clients. So, like the tech industry, the crypto, maybe not for the same reasons, but what those two industries have in common is the crypto industry has lately been suffering, and that was a big reason also behind the collapse of Signature Bank, that its clients, its loans were some of its loans may have been in default or higher levels of default because they were crypto companies, and then those commercial clients that had deposit accounts, they likely had to draw down their deposits some. And then for the same reason as Silicon Valley Bank, let's see, Signature Bank had only 10% of its deposits FDIC insured. And so they weren't, most of its deposits weren't insured. The value of its liquid assets had fallen with higher interest rates. And just like Silicon Valley Bank, they found they were not able to meet their depositors' needs.
And what about Barney Frank?
Played a role.
Yeah, James, Barney Frank, I mean, the Dodd-Frank legislation following the 2008 subprime mortgage crisis and financial crisis. I mean, it's named, he's got his name right on it, but Gail mentions Barney Frank as one of the people involved in Signature Bank. And from Politico the other day, Barney Frank says he blames the crypto panic for his bank's collapse.
Okay.
you don't fine. See it that way.
If you're a Signature Bank that doesn't, you know, you don't have a very diverse portfolio of customers and heavy in crypto. I don't care if you're heavy in crypto or heavy in bananas. If there's going to if the banana industry or the crypto industry or the tech industry or whatever you might have too many eggs in that basket collapses, then you're bank's going to be in a difficult situation. So,
yeah. One of the other reasons that I have seen blamed for these banks going under, and specifically from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, is wokeism. The ESG initiatives, environment, social, and government initiatives of these banks. Do you see that playing a role?
No, the problem here seems to be pretty specific about a non-diverse customer base that has started to draw down their deposits. So very specific industries here, the tech industry and the crypto industry. I don't know how wokeism comes into play there, but it's the combination of two industries that are suffering right now, that these banks happen to be specializing in, at the same time as interest rates going up and the value of those bonds that the banks are holding going down, at the same time as having, and this is about being non-diverse, also non-diverse customers also. I mean diverse in terms of the types of industries and the wealth of the customers. Having a very small percentage of your deposits actually FDIC insured. That's why we had runs on the banks. If we had a high fraction of those deposits FDIC insured, even if people thought the banks were going to collapse, there wouldn't be a worry. There wouldn't be a bank run on them because you would still feel secure in your deposits.
Well, and I want to ask, James, if this is potentially contagious. I see this morning that the Credit Suisse Bank shares fell more than 25% in today's trading, at least at last check. Is there a threat of contagion here among banks? And we got about a minute left.
Okay. Bank stocks around both sides of the Atlantic seem to have been falling. I won't put too much interpretation on what's happening with stock prices. That could rebound tomorrow. Whatever's going on the other side of the Atlantic doesn't seem to be the same issue. What's in common though are very large depositors, very wealthy depositors over there. There's a potential for contagion if people just start not trusting their bank. Like I said, even healthy banks, not a single bank around the world can survive a bank run without being bailed out or insured or something like that.
James,
so it is about confidence.
We'll have to leave it there for today, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Perfect. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. James Murray, professor of economics at UW-La Crosse, with us today to discuss the FDIC seizing Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank after they collapsed and how this shapes fiscal policy as it continues to move forward. Buy me some peanuts and a double shot espresso. I don't care if I never get back. The World Baseball Classic's underway, and the USA will be playing for a chance to make it to the quarterfinals tonight as they compete against Colombia at Arizona's Chase Field. But balls and strikes aren't what's grabbing all the headlines. The Italian baseball team has installed an espresso machine in their dugout. Italy's manager and 12-time Major League All-Star Mike Piazza says the worst part is having to drink his espresso out of a paper cup. It's kind of a sacrilege, Piazza said, but when it's the only option you have to deal with it. Maybe next time we'll bring the metallic machine with the copper eagle on the top and someone in there knocking espressos out. Italy's team's already made it to the World Baseball Classic's quarterfinals, and you have to wonder if this new sports energy drink might just catch on. In addition to a bat boy in the dugout, how long before teams have their own barista at the old ball game? I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and coming up, we go over yesterday's State of the Tribes address. But now, what's the biggest story across Wisconsin over these last couple of days? It has to be where the Green Bay Packers four-time MVP quarterback will be playing his 19th season. or whether he'll be playing football at all. Rumors are swirling around Aaron Rodgers, but as of last check, he has not been traded to another team, and he is still a Green Bay Packer. However, that didn't stop Rodgers from making clear his intentions earlier today on the Pat McAfee Show.
At this point, as I sit here, you know, I think since Friday, I made it clear that my intention was to play, and my intention was to play for the New York Jets.
Okay.
And I haven't been holding anything up at this point. It's been compensation that the Packers are trying to get.
Does he undermine that compensation by announcing his intentions outright this afternoon? Is there any chance Aaron Rodgers could be back in green and gold? And if not, what does that mean for the future of the Packers? And for longtime Packer fans, doesn't this offseason feel all too familiar? Pete Daugherty is the Packers columnist for USA Today Network Wisconsin. And Pete, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Lee. How are you today?
I am very curious about what Aaron Rodgers is doing and why he's announced his intentions to play for the New York Jets. Isn't this a decision to be made by the Packers, and doesn't he undermine his intent by announcing what he wants?
Well, he's got a lot of say in this whole thing because of his contract. He's going to be paid $59 million guaranteed this year. So all he has to do is show up. So if the Packers want to trade him, he needs to cooperate, because the team isn't going to trade for him unless he says he wants to play for him and is good with it. Nobody wants to trade for a quarterback who doesn't want to play for him. And he could always just up and retire and then unretire, you know, before the season starts. So that would just be a big mess. So no, he definitely has say in this. And, you know, we've all known for how long now? I'm not even sure how long this has been going. Over a week, I think, right? So the Jets went and visited him. Was that a week ago today? It might have been a week ago, or a week ago yesterday. It might have been. So we've known for at least a week here that this was going to happen.
And we also know that he had a wish list of players he'd like to play with, according to ESPN. And the Jets actually acquired one of those players on his list already.
Yeah, and it sounds like they're interested in at least one or maybe two of the others. He balked at that and said he didn't present him with a list. He said they asked him about players, what he thought of them. I'm sure he said something effect of, you know, it'd be great if you could bring these guys in. I doubt the whole deal swings on whether they, you know, sign these guys and bring in these guys that he played with the Packers. But, you know, they're doing everything they can to set up a situation that he wants to be in. That's pretty obvious.
Pete, you've been covering the Packers for 30 years now. Doesn't this sort of ring familiar to what happened to Hall of Fame quarterback Brett Favre in 2008? How would you compare and contrast that?
Yeah, it's just incredibly similar in so many ways. I mean, you know, they each had a replacement drafted in the first round. It took 3 years till it actually happened. You know, that guy sat behind Rodgers behind Favre for 3 years, Love behind Rodgers for 3 years. These things run their course. These quarterbacks get so big, they want more say in things. The teams, I think, wear down, you know, the maintenance that goes with it. With Favre, it was whether he would retire. With Rodgers, it was him being upset with the organization and then recouping some of his power by winning those two MVPs and getting a new contract. It's incredibly similar, and the Packers can only hope and pray that Jordan Love turns out to be something like the two guys before him. I mean, it's unheard of for the league to draft a Hall of Fame quarterback to replace one, and it would be off the charts unheard of to do that twice in a row with first Rodgers, and then if Love turned out to be anything like that kind of player.
So we're ready to write off Aaron Rodgers as a Packer in the coming NFL season. Is that right?
Yeah, I cannot imagine circumstances where he's back with the Packers now. That ain't happening.
So what does this mean for the green and gold this season? I mean, still they're in the NFC North, so you figure they've there's been a recent lack of competition in their football division. But what does the Packers look like with a new quarterback at the helm this year?
Yeah, it's a whole new world they're entering here. I mean, they entered it briefly in 08, you know, not knowing how good Rodgers would be. But by 09, they even halfway through 08, they signed him to a contract extension. And by 09, they made the playoffs. But you know, it was 22 years, I think, between Bart Starr and Brett Favre, and teams go longer than that. Chicago's been looking to replace Sid Luckman, and I think he retired in 51. So, you know, this is a brand new world. They're getting to, they'll spend at least a season or half a season learning how it's, what it's like to be, you know, amongst the other half of the NFL. It'll be really interesting to see how good this guy is. How, what kind of coach is Matt LaFleur when he doesn't have a Hall of Fame quarterback? How will the offense look different? It was, you know, LaFleur changed the offense to, you know, to appease Rodgers, to meet him halfway on some of the things Rodgers likes to do. Now we'll presumably see more pure version of LaFleur's offense with a young quarterback. It'll be really interesting times, and lots on the line, because if Love isn't good enough, and they know that by the end of the 23 season, then they're right back, you know, looking for a new quarterback next year at this time.
Pete Daugherty, our guest, Packers columnist for USA Today, Network Wisconsin. And Pete, we started the conversation with talking about Aaron Rodgers guaranteed, what was it, $59 million this year?
Yeah, basically, yep.
Does that free up any room for the Packers to move and make some big acquisitions before the season kicks off?
It does not, because, you know, to get into the, I don't want to get too deep into the nuances of the salary cap, but it actually, to keep him, he would have counted $31 million on the cap. To trade him, because of the way the cap rules work, where his salary this year comes off, but future prorated money all accelerates to this year, they actually, he'll cost $40 million on the cap with the trade, so that's $9 million more. So they'll actually have $9 million less cap room to work with, but the huge upside is they're not stacking all this $59 million onto future caps, which they would be if they kept him. So he's off their books next year. They're free and clear. He won't count anymore next year. So next year at this time, they'll have a lot more money to work with than they would have if they had kept him.
So I appreciate you speculating earlier, but if you look at the NFC North this season, what are the Packers' shot without Aaron Rodgers and making the playoffs this year?
You know, you would think pretty slim. I mean, they went, you know, look how good Aaron Rodgers turned out to be, and they went 6-10 in his first year as a starter. So even if Love turns out to be a really good quarterback, I would think this would still be a pretty rough year. And if he's not good enough, it could be a really rough year. You never know. They went 9-7 in Favre's first year as a starter, didn't make the playoffs, but they did go 9-7. So if I were betting just right now, I would, you know, guess around a 5 or 6 or 7 win season. But, you know, you just don't know how Love is going to play. So you just, the smart money says, even if he looks pretty good and looks like he's a keeper, he's going to make a young quarterback's mistakes, enough of them to lose them a bunch of games.
Well, if there's a feel good in all this, I'd have to imagine that it's what you said earlier. The Bears are still looking for their next Sid Luckman.
And yeah, I mean, even the Vikings have been looking for a quarterback for a long time. It's hard to, these guys are hard to find.
Yes.
They really are. You know, the Broncos since Elway, they haven't found one. You know, they tried Russell Wilson, so far not so good. So that's a merry-go-round you definitely don't want to be getting on in the NFL.
Hey, Pete, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, thanks for having me, Lee.
Pete Daugherty is the Packers columnist for USA Today Network Wisconsin, with us today to look at the future of Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an ode to a car.
Some people get really passionate about taking sides on everyday things that make our lives a little sweeter. Coke versus Pepsi, the Beatles versus the Stones, Biggie versus Tupac, and of course, manual versus automatic transmission. Writer Nancy Jorgensen is team manual and tells us about her love of and nostalgia for driving stick shift.
A few months before our wedding, my boyfriend bought me a car I couldn't drive. A cherry red two-door Volkswagen Beetle, like a little sugar bun, round and sweet. I settled in the bucket seat, hesitant after my single parking lot lesson on manual transmissions. I checked the mirrors, jerked into traffic. Don't be afraid on the hill. I shifted, gave it gas. Sedans and station wagons zipped past. The engine putt-putt sputtered, quit. A rookie with four on the floor I didn't realize the car was in third gear. I fumbled with the clutch and stick, and after several attempts, found first gear and slipped back on the road. As the four-cylinder, 60-horsepower engine purred in the rear, I relaxed a bit and let the wind tangle my hair. By the time I pulled into our alley garage, imaginary stars twinkled my Beetle, with its pedal for my left foot and its knob for my right hand. Already, I craved more practice with step ball change choreography. Soon, the clutch and I were like lovers. We went everywhere together. My parents' house to swim in the pool, my grandma's cottage to gather beans and eggs, my daughter's daycare center so I could teach choir classes at work. In summer, with the windows cranked, driving delivered whiffs of freshly cut grass. In winter, with a hole in the floorboard, commuting coughed up ice and sleet. That car wedded me to the road, so close were the steering wheel and windshield, so tight the space between me and Wisconsin's wavering weather. Eventually, I traded my 72 Bug for a family car with four doors. But every vehicle since, 87, 97, 09, required my left foot dance with a clutch. Five years ago, when a surgeon damaged my boyfriend, now husband's, left leg, we surrendered our manual transmission. The dealer almost refused our trade-in. "No one wants a stick shift anymore," he said. "Won't be able to sell it." Is it possible to pine for a pedal? To love a rubber-covered hunk of metal? To feel an absent clutch like a phantom limb? I sense its presence. I anticipate using it. My leg twitches and hovers in its void. But the clutch isn't all I've lost. I'll never again have parents with a backyard pool. No more grandma with gardens and chickens. No more baby daughters strapped in the back seat. Nostalgia is like a 1970s poncho. It covers me in discordant threads, some delicate, light, and brief, some weighty, rough, and lasting. Strands of memory intertwine, and it's impossible to separate one from the others. Last week, a snappy little convertible with a lion's roar zoomed past me in the park, and I felt something like longing. I imagined myself in a leather seat, downshifting on a hill, gliding through gears, third, fourth, fifth, cruising Lake Michigan's shore, sailboats on the horizon, leaning into curves at 50 miles an hour. In real life, I get behind the wheel of my SUV. A screen tells me where to go. An air conditioner cools to a precise number, and a cabin cradles me far above the bumpy pavement. But it's hard to navigate when the parts I love the most are no longer there.
Nancy Jorgensen is a writer who lives in Waukesha. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we get a look at 2023's State of the Tribes address and what Indigenous leaders are advocating for in Wisconsin. That's next, here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn. The 2023 State of the Tribes address was held yesterday at the state capitol. It covered the opioid epidemic, environmental issues, and more. The annual speech dates back to 2005, and it gives Wisconsin's tribes a chance to highlight issues that are important to Indigenous communities across the state. Here to share more about yesterday's address is Richard Ackley, a retired judge for the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. And Judge Ackley, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me on again.
Yeah, yesterday the address was given by Sacagawea Chippewa community leader, Chairman Robert Van Zyle, Jr. What stood out to you about his address?
What I liked about Tribal Chairman Van Zyle's presentation is, I must do a historic note, I believe at times the speeches of the tribes by the state to the state of the State of the Tribe address that's given to the Wisconsin State Legislature, that high schools and colleges should hear that, because one of the interesting dynamics is I don't believe enough people in the state have a in-depth understanding of native issues or native sovereignty. And then two, the tribes have a system where other tribal chairmen contribute to the speech. And it would be nice if, and I really appreciate the fact that the governor, the executive staff, the elected officials, attorney general, the Senate, and the assembly were present. But sometimes, even though they sit together, in the tribes, they look for collective views of expressing themselves. And I'm hoping in some ways that that reflection of their collective unity could be a reflection of the unity of the elected officials and the executives in the state of Wisconsin. And I'll be kind of quick because the limit.
Oh, and we just lost our guest. I apologize. Judge Richard Ackley joining us with a discussion about yesterday's State of the Tribes address given by Chairman Robert Van Zyl Jr. Mentioned a number of issues, and we'll get right back to him with Judge Ackley as soon as we can connect to him. As long as I've got the opportunity here, let me run down tomorrow morning right here on the Ideas Network for you. Coming up tomorrow on the morning show, Kate Archer Kent will be examining a recent Harvard Kennedy School study on the decline of local news, the impact on civic life, and what we here at public radio might be able to do to fill the void. Also tomorrow, silver medalist Kenny Bednarik from Rice Lake joins the morning show. He's an Olympic silver medalist. Take a look at the life, a day in the life of a professional track and field athlete. And also tomorrow morning from 7 to 9, UW lacrosse historian looks at the people we choose to literally put on our pedestals and why they are so few honoring women. That's tomorrow on the morning show from 7 to 9 right here on the Ideas Network. Do we have Judge Ackley back yet? We do not. Gives me an opportunity to tell you what's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. And we have coming up tomorrow, the House of Representatives Weaponization of Government Subcommittee. Perhaps you've heard a little something about this so far. They've made some stunning claims about what they think is happening in Washington, D.C. Tomorrow, we look at the evidence and what evidence have the hearings have produced so far and what history tells us about how this investigation is likely to proceed and ultimately end. Also, tomorrow afternoon on Central Time, we're making a list, and we're going to solicit your support for the very best bad movies, your favorite trashy movies. They can't all be Oscar contenders. They're not all best movies. Sometimes a really good bad flick can make a perfect movie night, and I know you've got one in mind, so tomorrow, with your help and our guests, we're asking you to help make our list with our help. Let me see if we've got Judge Ackley joining us. Is he here? Yes. Judge Ackley, welcome back.
Yeah, there were some technical difficulties. I don't know if it's on my phone or your system, but that would be sort of my summary comments.
I appreciate that. Now to some of the specifics with the time we have remaining. One of the big issues yesterday was health care. Chairman Robert Van Zyl Jr. talked about how we can support Native communities when it comes to health care. How so, Judge Ackley?
Well, there were three statements in that. One is the nurse practitioners, due to profit and nonprofit hospitals, to me, the regulatory systems of the state perhaps could address that. And the other aspect is Marquette University or the medical college or the University of Wisconsin has their medical school. I know at St. Norbert's, where I live in Green Bay, they have a medical school. There ought to be some way that a nurse practitioner can be part of the team. So to me, that's a regulatory issue. Two, the Medicare, which receiving federal funds in the state and the tribe, they ought to find a way to work on that, not segment that. And the third one is mental health, opioid, other issues. That brings awareness from all parties, law enforcement, counselors, and other types. So to me, those needs to be responsive issues by the state elected officials and their staff.
Judge Ackley, what do we know about how the opioid epidemic has hit our Native communities in Wisconsin?
Well, it's like many communities. There, you know, we live side by side, but the multi-jurisdictional task forces are working together. But as Van Zyl said, no matter what race, color, creed you are, they want to make sure that they stop the flow. So it's not necessarily northern tribes. I live in Green Bay, where there's a large tribal community, other places. So to me, it's a statewide issue and a national issue, so you have to address it in the models that are presented in coordination and cooperation to eradicate either to healthcare, law enforcement, and other factors. So that's just an ongoing issue, and tribal communities are part within the state of Wisconsin. So that's another cooperative venture that could be explored.
Chairman Van Zyl referred to a black cloud hanging over Indigenous Wisconsinites yesterday in a State of the Tribes address, and he was talking about team mascots. What can we do about our team mascots, Judge Ackley?
Well, in 2005, when John Guard, the Republican Assembly, and then Act 31, is things have rapidly improved with the current Secretary of Interior. I'm not reflecting either Democrat or Republican, but the current Secretary of Interior has eliminated some of the names that are offensive within their federal systems for, you know, the National Park or Shawangunk National Forest or whatever those areas. And to me, education, whether it be Act 39, tribal people have to be, and non-tribal people have to be respectful of language. And since I didn't realize from 2005 to 2023, the Washington Commanders, and I remember back when this took place, the Marquette has changed. So has to happen. And it's out of respect for all parties.
Judge Ackley, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. And I do apologize about the technical difficulties. And there is so much more for us to talk about with the State of the Tribes address yesterday that took place at the state capitol. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then we talk with a reporter who spent a full school year shadowing a trio of teachers. She shares their stories in her new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time.